The Scholarly Discourse from Research Information.
Welcome to Research Information's Women in Scholarly Communications series, supported by Cactus Communications. This is Tim Gillett. In this edition, I met Amy Brand, who is director and publisher at MIT Press. Amy, it's very nice to meet you. Thanks very much for joining us. I'd like to start by going back to the beginning of your career, if that's all right. Your academic background was in linguistics and cognitive science, if I'm right. What attracted you to the intersection of research and publishing rather than staying in academia?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I've never really left academia, and there's, to me, very clear continuity between studying language and studying how minds process language and the work around curating and disseminating information. In many ways, I feel like I could easily have stayed in academia, but the work that I do today and have done for a long time on different parts of research communication feels very consistent with those interests.
So you've worked in scholarly communications, but also across university administration and research infrastructure as well. And a bit of technology. Which experiences do you think have shaped the way that you lead at MIT Press now?
I do think that what matters to me and how I think about what a publisher based at a university should be doing is pretty distinctive. And I would say it's colored by all of those things, but perhaps shaped most by the experience of working on tenure and promotion at Harvard University, at a prestigious university, and thinking about how we determine excellence in the production of knowledge. And so there's that, and then there's the relationship between what we do in the academic publishing space and academic career trajectories, how universities work, all of that. So.
And do you have much ongoing connection with the university itself? And the library.
At MIT?
Yeah.
At MIT? Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I work very, very closely with other units and departments at MIT. Right now, we're working very closely with Open Learning on some experimental work and projects around the future of textbooks. You know, MIT is known for open courseware, among other things. And some of that involves working with graduate students and faculty and other departments directly, and just how actually university presses tend to be governed and structured within universities. You always have a community of interested faculty. For us, it's through our faculty editorial board, but we also have a management board that includes many administrators at MIT, as well as faculty and folks on the outside.
Careers are strange things sometimes. They move in ways that you often don't expect them to. Looking back over the various parts of your career, was there an event or a decision or something that happened that had a much bigger impact than you expected it to?
I've had this habit throughout my career of taking these kind of leaps of faith, because I have this deep belief, and I've talked to my kids about this too, that you kind of get farther faster by taking risks, making mistakes, reassessing. And I also feel like all the jumps and moves that I've made, they haven't been necessarily leaving something behind. They've been, cumulative. But I guess the biggest jump that I did take was leaving, academic science and leaving research. I always think about that as having been, even though I'm still at a university and working closely with academics, that I can so easily imagine what that career path would have been like.
Do you have any regrets over that?
Actually, no, I don't. Except maybe when I think about the academic calendar and sabbaticals. I am envious of that, I would say.
Yes. So. Okay. Great. Thank you. MIT Press has been has become recognized for being kind of experimental with new publishing models. is pushing for constant innovation and change, is that constrained by the financial realities of running a university press? I mean, obviously, we'd all like limitless budgets, but we don't get them.
Yeah, I actually see it kind of the opposite way, because I feel like it's, you know, the climate, ongoing change and challenge that we're all working through necessitates ongoing innovation. So yes, it's true that, you know, in order to do the work of investigating and planning, you know, and visioning, you do need resources. But I mean, especially now, given how quickly things are moving, I think, you know, either you take a leading role in innovate, or you're just left behind.
Absolutely. So what one of these innovations was Direct to Open, mm-hmm. which has been around for how long? About 8 years, something like that.
I think so. Yeah.
So that allows authors to publish open access regardless of their institution or their funding. Mm-hmm. And it's received a lot of attention. Looking back, has it been a big success? And what do you think are the biggest lessons that you've learned from that?
It has been, on the whole. I mean, there are some things I would have done differently, but it has been hugely successful. And for us, when I, you know, our goal was, and the way we measured success was the impact that it had beyond MIT across the community. And it engendered a lot of copycat models and others coming on board. And that's really what we wanted to see. So I think it was a big factor in the growth in Open Monograph publishing. We didn't necessarily get the business model right from the outset, you know, especially now. I, you know, feel comfortable sharing with you that we feel like we probably underpriced it. Okay. And, you know, we are having to incrementally adjust the overall model to make it cover its costs.
Okay, thank you. If you could look back over your career, could you identify the biggest challenges that you've seen within the wider industry, not necessarily within university presses?
Yeah, I've written a lot about this issue that I have felt throughout, is this sort of tribalism and polarization between the library and publisher communities. I was having dinner with a friend who works at a much larger company the other night, and he said, you know, oh, Elsevier has done us a big favor. It's like a lightning rod, and it attracts the attention away from, you know, negative attention away from the rest of the publishing industry. I said, actually, it kind of works in both directions, right? I mean, there is understandable frustration within the academic community at the commercial interests of large publishers. And I think that, you know, attitude, understandable attitude and stance towards publishing carries over into, you know, often how publishers in general are viewed. And so, you know, and I have felt fairly comfortable going back and forth between the academic library side and the publisher side. But, you know, I can't remember the exact phrasing or ideas that I've, you know, put down in various articles I've written about this, but I feel like when people are acting, you know, out of that kind of anger, resentment, it doesn't lead to the best long-term decision-making. And, you know, I think we've seen that play out in the whole, you know, history of open access.
Do you think we're in a better place than we were, say, 10, 15, 20 years ago now?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, yes, when it comes to the open sharing of knowledge, I think we are in a much better place. I think that there are a lot of unknowns about how AI, generative AI, and how it consumes academic content, what factor that's going to play in terms of access to knowledge. I think in many ways, you know, the publishing community, commercial and non-commercial, you know, works to support the research enterprise and adjusts fairly nimbly in response to things like government policy. And, you know, there's some big question marks right now about where that's going to go.
So. Yeah, clearly. clearly. Obviously, there's always talk about technology transforming publishing, and Research Information was actually set up to cover the move from print to digital.
Which is
long gone. And in fact, I was reminiscing with Mandy Hill from Cambridge on an interview a couple of weeks ago about how I had interviewed her 10 years previously, and we hadn't used the words artificial intelligence in the entire conversation, and that's only 10 years.
Wow. Yeah. I remember I once gave a talk, I can't remember what conference it was at, and I challenged myself not to use the term innovation throughout, just, you know, it was a useful exercise.
Yeah. Do you think that despite all this onslaught of technology, that people are still the most important thing, and in what way?
Yes, I you know, resounding yes, and I think the stakes are even higher, you know, in the work that we do in terms of human judgment and discernment and curation. One of the things that I, you know, spend a lot of time thinking about right now, both in terms of the work of publishing, but, you know, even more generally, is the importance of maintaining our ability to know what's credible and what's true and what's trustworthy. And, you know, I think ultimately that does come down to human curation and human judgment. And so I am actually very optimistic. You know, if you look at the peer review system and how it's been stressed, you know, and things like the reproducibility crisis, I think these new technologies are going to make us better at what we do, but that doesn't mean that they replace, they help, they don't replace the human being who is doing the curation and the judgment and discernment.
Yeah, absolutely. So, could you pick a balance between opportunity and the need to be cautious, or is it kind of 50 in your mind?
Well, I mean, yes, I think we have to be extremely cautious. We're in a situation now where, you know, the interests of these large labs, you know, fundamentally may not be in alignment with the interests of the academic community in terms of sharing knowledge in the most trustworthy, verifiable way. And of course, it's also, these technologies have really changed what it means to write, you know, and to be an author. And so we are all reevaluating, you know, authorship at this moment in many, many ways. You know, I had worked with several colleagues on the credit taxonomy years ago to look at the various contribution roles that factor into multi-authored work, right? And now we have to think about where AI, you know, fits in that taxonomy.
Yeah, and it's developing every 6 months.
Yes, exactly.
You're dealing with a new issue or a new problem or a new opportunity, I guess. Yeah. So looking back at organizations outside of scholarly publishing that you worked at, which is Harvard Digital Science and the like, as well as a publisher, how has your leadership style evolved over time? And did it need to be different in different parts of the ecosystem?
Yeah, I think time is really the, you know, the operative parameter here, less than the organizations. I think, you know, I fell into leadership fairly early in my career. You know, even when I was in college, I always found myself running organizations and things. And, you know, and yet I'm a fairly shy person. And I can remember feeling, you know, a lot of pressure to be charismatic, you know, as these leadership roles grew. And yet, you know, in hindsight, what's mattered is, you know, having a real deep interest in doing the work and solving the problems. And to me, that's really what leadership is. And so when I'm given an opportunity to talk about what I've learned about leadership, it's the people who show up, the people that are interested in other people, the people that can sit back and listen. And you know, it's not a performative responsibility.
Okay. And was being a leader, I mean, you're you're recognized as being pretty very influential, I should say.
It's funny. I don't think of myself that way, but thank you.
But the fact is, you are. Was it something that you aimed for from the beginning? Have you always been ambitious? You mentioned that you were shy, but that doesn't necessarily preclude being ambitious.
I was ambitious to solve bigger and harder problems, right? That was my ambition. And so, you know, in hindsight, when I looked at the career moves and the things that involved being promoted into positions of responsibility, you know, that came for me out of, you know, wanting to have a shot at solving a problem or helping an organization. Just truly on an intellectual level, like, you know, thinking this is extremely hard. I want to work on that problem. So for example, when I was at Harvard, I was at first working in the Office for Scholarly Communication, which was just getting off the ground. I was the founding program manager because Harvard had the first faculty open access mandate. And I ended up in a position that was effectively, you know, newly created, not exactly around me, but it was a brand new position that around understanding the relationship between types of faculty data like publication and grants and tenure and promotion, and working with all of these, you know, data systems behind the scenes. And that was, to me, was just, you know, kid in the candy store kind of thing. So it really has the interest in, you know, solving difficult problems and is what has driven me, and, you know, the interest in other people. I always say that to be happy in a leadership position, you have to find other people, how their minds work, you know, fascinating. So,
for sure. Absolutely. Yeah. What advice would you give to someone who's entering scholarly publishing or communications today, who wants to make it meaningful and lasting in terms of the impact they have?
Yeah, I would say, you know, don't necessarily think about it in terms of scholarly publishing. Think about it in terms of the research information and research technology space, which of course now also means AI. And you know, the importance of being able to share knowledge effectively. What is that work? What is that work going to be like in the future? You know, another thing I've found myself saying recently is that research isn't knowledge until it's effectively communicated. And so when you're thinking about, you know, wanting to be helpful or have a job in communicating research there, it goes well beyond the way we think of traditional roles in scholarly publishing.
Yeah. Absolutely. So talking of the future, future gazing is notoriously difficult and troublesome. But if you imagine that we're sitting here in 10 years' time, what would you like to see that MIT Press will have achieved and the industry more broadly?
We are in the middle of all of us embracing the fact that we are no longer just publishing for other human readers, right? And we know that we are publishing for AI-mediated access to knowledge, and yet the business models around that have yet to emerge. And so, you know, I'm extremely hopeful. The thing that seems most critical to me and what I'd like to see in the future is that we have financial models around AI-mediated access to knowledge that sustain this industry, because I think it's absolutely critical. And I think it's critical for the AI labs as well.
And presumably MIT Press is working on that.
Yes, we are.
Okay. Is there an issue in scholarly communications that you think isn't receiving enough attention at the moment?
I'm kind of stumped on that one, because I feel like when something's important, I go right after it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this issue again of, you know, the business models, and what I'll just to go a little bit deeper on that. You know, I've seen many excellent ideas to begin addressing, coming up with these ongoing revenue streams and business models for publishers. I think the problem we're having right now is the way in which the publishing industry and the AI industry work and communicate, and how to scale that. I am concerned about smaller publishers being somewhat left behind. We've already seen a lot of consolidation in the industry, and now there are more pressures than ever around scale on both sides. And so, you know, it is a problem that the solutions that the industry, the publishing industry, are coming up with are not necessarily being received the way they should by the AI companies. So I'm not seeing the partnerships yet that I want to see.
Right, that's the serious stuff over. outside of work, what keeps you occupied?
Outside of work, you can probably hear my dog barking. you know, I'm very outdoors oriented. So hiking, we try to swim every day in the summer. I do lots of yoga. I have three young adult kids and try to spend as much time as I can with them. Yeah, and a lot of reading, some gardening, lots of cooking. I would say we've been spending a lot of time entertaining people too. We love to have people over to our house now.
Lovely, so. Lovely. And finally, if you hadn't gone into scholarly communications, what's your alternative career?
Lots of interest. You know, I've had this very, you know, I would say low level in terms of time sideline and documentary film. And I absolutely love the medium. And I can also imagine having had a career where that was my full-time gig, or, you know, working on documentary films.
Wow.
Another form of storytelling. So yeah,
that can be your next move.
Yes, that's right.
Right, Amy, that feels like a great place to finish. Thank you ever so much for your time, your knowledge, and your wisdom. And it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much, Tim. I really appreciate it. It's good to speak with you. Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
The Scholarly Discourse, from Research Information.